Welcome to our series on social capital. My name is Tristan Claridge, and I'm the director of the Institute for Social Capital. And I'm joined by Lyndon Robison, Emeritus Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at Michigan State University. Welcome, Lyndon.
Thank you, Tristan. Good to be here.
Lyndon and I share a passion for the concept of social capital, and we each have a long history of work on the concept. However, we have quite different backgrounds and perspectives. Lyndon is from economics, and my background is in sociology and social theory, and our different backgrounds and perspectives make for interesting conversations and engaging debates. So in this episode, we'll discuss how social capital is created and maintained. In previous episodes, we've discussed what social capital does, we've discussed why it's capital, and different understanding, different ways of understanding what it is. But in this episode, we're going to dive more deeply into the nature of social capital as a stock and a flow. And just as physical capital never works alone, neither does social capital. Lyndon, how would you describe the processes involved in creating and maintaining social capital?
Well, thank you for a great question. And that's a, I think, a wonderful way to start our discussion today. And for me, before I can answer the question, I at least have to share what in my mind I think of when I think about social capital. And I think, first of all, that it has to be, as we've discussed, something that represents a potential, like all capital does. Has to produce a flow, has to gain resources from others. So the definition that I would start with of social capital, something that we need to be maintained, would be connecting emotions that between people in a relationship that makes their well-being interdependent. There would be a number of these, such as sympathy, empathy, trust, regard, caring, and so on. But the net result is that I am made better off when your well-being is improved, or worse off when your well-being is harmed. So, how would I recommend that we maintain those that social capital between people? And one of the ways is that we acknowledge existing commonalities, things that we share, and create new ones when that's possible, that possibility. So people that I'm working with or studying or traveling with or live next to or engage in political, social, cultural, sporting events provide opportunities to build commonalities that can then be used as a basis for creating and maintaining social capital.
And we often think about commonalities being very broad characteristics, such as gender or race or perhaps religion. But often what we're talking about with social capital is finding commonalities of values or commonalities of interests or commonalities of belonging. There's a whole range of different commonalities that are probably more relevant and more appropriate than those broad macro commonalities, aren't there?
Often we will divide commonalities into those that we earn by a conscious choice and others that we share because of the conditions of our birth that we're made aware of. For example, our gender, age, nationality, a number of those are inherited at birth. Others, such as where we live, work, where we've traveled, and so on. Are earned that we, through our own choices, created this commonality. And the third category, which I think of as maybe somewhere in between, would be a covenant commonality. For example, when two people get married, they enter into this sort of lifetime agreement on terms and conditions that says we share something in common. That we create through a covenant of agreement that's intended to last a long time, to be a potential of connecting emotions.
And so communication seems like it's a key way to identify and perhaps build these commonalities. And so I often think about reaching consensus or agreement about things. And certainly in the social capital literature, it's common to see reference to a variety of shared understandings. You know, things like social norms are understandings that are widely shared or understood between multiple people. So it seems to me that communication is fundamental to all of this. If we're talking about how is social capital created, then I think communication has to be one of those key aspects or key processes that create social capital.
I couldn't agree more. And it's always interesting to me when in fact, we have experienced that in our conversations, one of us will bring up a term or an expression that's very clearly understood from our background, but not from your background or from my background. And it's only after some amount of communication and exchange and comparison does that. Which we didn't obvious appear to be a commonality. We find out, in fact, it is a commonality, but that required some effort. It required us to compare what our backgrounds were and so on. And I find that in building social capital, that how you build these connecting emotions requires a lot of communication and exchanges of favors and activities and so on to build something that can produce goods that satisfy our human needs that make a relationship productive.
And so we could describe that as a process. It's a process of investment that creates that understanding or creates those commonalities. These are perhaps different ways of describing what social capital is. And that stock then can produce a flow of benefits. But if we stay on that process side of how it's created, it seems like even covenants, various types of agreements are reached through communication. They're agreements that we come to understand between us. Even when someone uses the term, "Oh, we're friends, aren't we?" That explicitly communicates effectively an agreement that we're both on the same page about this. Oh, yes, we're both friends. People when they're romantically involved may say, "Oh, we're dating now," and that's a form of agreement that from then on, we un both understand that we're now dating. And of course, as you mentioned, when we enter into a marriage, that's a even more formalized covenant or agreement about the nature of a relationship. So communication is fundamental to all of these processes.
So, if these shared commonalities that are improved through communication and repeated interactions of sharing social acts that convey caring or interest or regard or something, if that's the process of building social capital, this potential. Then there may be another aspect of this process that builds social capital between people. This same process may build or change the meaning and value of things. For example, at one point, my mother gave me the ring that was owned by one of my ancestors. This ring had now been passed down through generations. And was now mine. To me, it wasn't a just a ring. It was if you said, well, the metal content and this is not very significant, I would probably agree. But as a sort of a place where these emotional or relational goods were associated and were embedded, this became a very valuable thing, which something I think we called attachment value goods in the past.
And there's many, many examples of these attachment value goods or these symbols, perhaps is another word we could use to describe it. that reinforce and have meaning and shape the nature of social capital, really, how we feel about other people. And I think this gets to the idea that the communication that we engage in to create social capital can be just conversation, just verbal two-way communication can certainly shape the kinds of commonalities and the shared understandings and emotional feelings and so forth related to each other. But there's also nonverbal communication as well. Like, take the very simple example of a handshake. You know, this is a nonverbal gesture. It's a symbol of friendship that communicates meaning and significance, but it still is a form of communication that then shapes the nature of social capital. And there's many other nonverbal examples of communication that we engage in. And then we can go further than that and look at forms of one-way communication as well that perhaps communicate shape the nature of commonalities and emotions and shared understandings that is what social capital is. So yeah, I think we can think about communication in a variety of different ways.
I guess if I could add to what you've said, which I agree with, it would be the role of attachment value goods or symbols to create social capital without the requirement of face-to-face communication or face-to-face social or political or work experiences. If you know that with another group, you share attachment value for the same symbol. In religion, it could be the cross, the crescent, the Star of David, number of these sacred symbols, and you know that this group shares your attachment value. That can be an important attachment value that leads to a relationship. And even though you may not have had the face-to-face communication, you have had experiences with the same attachment value good. So it's those kind of things, but those originated at some point with people producing relational goods, whether they get exchanged directly or get embedded in things. It's still, I think we would agree that social capital lives in people. It's where it originates, and it can get embedded in things, produce things that exchange and can change the nature of our connections. But still, people are what we're talking about when we're talking, where does social capital live?
And I think that brings up a really important question is can social capital exist between strangers and people who don't have an existing relationship? And I guess you've highlighted the process by which social capital or meaning can be embedded in things, whether they be symbols and physical artifacts or in fact within groups and organizations. And take the example of a church. If you meet a fellow member of the same church, perhaps in a church, in a physical location, do you have empathy already for that individual because of those symbols, because of the meaning that is derived from that sense of belonging, that identity, that position, and all of those kinds of things? Is there already empathy, sympathy, in the kinds of feelings we associate with social capital towards other individuals who are effectively strangers?
In my opinion, yes. I mean, as soon as I know something about you, I see you, I sit by you, I know something about you, then I am moved from my sort of whatever that arm's length or indifferent position is. We're no longer strangers, although the our connection may be our connection if through a common symbol or a shared institution may not be as strong as someone that we grew up with and eat or share meals or something. Still, this connection is on a continuum. And if there is such a point as zero where we're not connected, once I meet you or recognize you or understand we share something, however small, we're no longer strangers. In my understanding.
So I often think about this as social capital having collective properties as well as individual properties. And so what I mean by collective properties is those properties of a collective, such as a church or another, a different institution or a social grouping, that effectively pre-exist the formation of individual social relationships, and therefore immediately or pre-exist, they actually shape the nature of relationships before they even start to form. And so there's various properties of the collective then that can exert that influence on the nature of interaction, the nature of relationships as they form. But then, of course, as those relationships form, then individual properties are developed. You know, if you and I were to meet in a church, the pre-existing properties of the collective would influence the nature of our interaction. But then, as we start to interact, we would develop our own relationship with its own properties that the church and that environment would continue to exert influence on the nature of our relationship, but we would develop our own properties. And so this is the reason why I say that social capital has both the collective properties as well as the individual properties.
There is agreed. There is another interesting question. Suppose that there is an organization like a company that produces a product, and this product its value can be enhanced if it acquires attachment value. I'm thinking about sporting where songs, air rides and airlines, and just a host of things. And if I'm the director of such a company and I'm producing products, how do I get my products distinguished from my competitors if physically they are the same thing? That one brand of dog food or breakfast cereal is pretty much identical to the other. How is it that I get mine distinguished? And at least from my background, it looks like they're trying to embed some kind of relational goods in their product. And so, how do you embed relational goods in a product? I mean, how do you make my tennis shoes or sporting shoes different than someone else's? And it's interesting that you hire someone who publicly has a lot of social capital. A lot of people look to this person and say, I admire, I regard, I'm impressed, or even care about this person in some way, that when he or she associates with a product, that product acquires attachment value. And if that person messes up, that attachment value can be destroyed in a hurry too.
Yeah, and the advertising industry knows this all too well. You know, if you think about how margarine is advertised, you know, there's 20 different margarine products that are effectively identical to each other in the supermarket. So you can't advertise on the basis of the properties of the product. So what they do instead is they'll have an ad where, you know, there's a mother in a kitchen preparing breakfast and son walks in, you know, smiling and happy and getting ready for school, and they hug and embrace, you know. So they're trying to associate the product with some sort of a emotion, some sort of relational good, so that when you're walking down the aisle in the supermarket and you see that particular margarine and amongst all of the others, you'll buy it because of the way you feel about it. So advertising industry knows this all too well, that this has a significant influence on the nature of our actions.
Yeah. And I know, for example, I get in the mail a flyer from a particular company that says, we just gave you $15 or 10% off if you come in and exercise this card. And so I look at this and say, are you trying to earn my loyalty or encourage my purchasing from your company on the basis of commodity discounts? And if so, why? Do you hope that by buying your product at this discount, that somehow I will acquire attachment value for your company because I associate with your sales force or I'm pleased with your product? So as an economist, I'm interested in both the incentives from lower cost and convenience, but as someone interested in social capital, I find it interesting how we're combining relational goods and attachment values along with commodity and price incentives to promote a product.
Yeah. And I think that relationships and our position within society, it's commonly understood, and it's used in so many different places, and that's what the concept of social capital tries to get at and tries to illustrate, illuminate the importance of these kinds of issues. I'm reminded of some research that was done looking at littering in national parks. And they compared the rate of littering when the sign said, you'll be fined $500 for littering, compared to a sign that said something more like, thank you for not littering. Or even, we keep our environment beautiful here, something like that. And the rate of littering was significantly higher when there was a fine was advertised on the sign. Whereas when it was shown to be relationally appropriate to not litter, the rate of littering was much, much lower. And so this speaks to the importance of how we see ourselves within relationships and how that influences the nature of our actions.
Couldn't agree more. And I know that we struggle to find a precise definition of social capital, but I think we can generally agree that it has to do with how we are connected, our relationship to each other, and how we're connected. And what is it that we exchange between each other that affects that value? I mean, we can exchange things, we can alter the terms and level on which we exchange. We can exchange simply, as you've referred to them, as social act, shaking hands, smiling, inviting a person to join, just a number of different ways that we exchange things between us that is more than just a thing being exchanged for a price and results in, at least in what my definition of social capital, creates a resource, an enhanced resource, more likely and more capable of exchanging whatever it is that we're doing.
I think as we've discussed, I think the key here is that it's created and maintained through communication, through interaction, through exchange. But we've also identified that it doesn't need to be two-way communication necessarily, that one-way communication, such as even a sign that says, thank you for not littering, that one-way communication can actually shape the nature of people's actions and change things as well. If I saw someone on a friend of mine on television, it's clearly going to be one-way communication, but the things that they said and that one-way communication would likely shape the nature of the relationship I have with that person, what I think and feel about that person through one-way communication. And so organizations can they can print a letter, a flyer, a memo, and send it out. And that one-way form of communication can help to shape the nature of people's emotions and thoughts and perceptions. So this all then communicates or illuminates the ways in which social capital is created and maintained.
Absolutely. An example that we often use, or at least I've used in the past, is if you walked into the grocery store and they were having some kind of promotion on say flowers, and you were given those flowers simply because you won or you happened to be the 50th customer walking through the door, as opposed to receiving those same flowers as an expression of caring and regard from a family member or someone else, even though the physical good, the flowers are the identical, what is conveyed and how it affects the relationship is absolutely different. And I think that's one of the things that we're trying to convey in the strength of social capital is it's trying to express sort of this intangible good that is building behind relationships that can be embedded in things and change the value and meaning of things without using up physical resources. The capacity to create goods, that is, things that improve our well-being without burning coal, polluting the rivers or the air. If this became a recognized opportunity, what a great thing. Its potential would be awesome in preserving, getting people to not litter, to get people to respect wildlife or natural resources. What a resource that could be on so many fronts. I know you've been involved in how do we preserve and how do we become more concerned with our natural resources. And I think social capital may provide the key for doing just that.
Yeah, and I think that's a really great point that it doesn't cost anything to smile, to acknowledge somebody, to show somebody regard or respect. All of these things are very easy to do, and don't take any physical resources, but they do create a good. They create something that it has a potential that can create future benefits for both for the person who is giving regard and acknowledging and respect, but also for the other person involved in as well. And this is what social capital is all about. And clearly, if we did a bit more of this, then we would have better outcomes.
Absolutely.
Well, we've run out of time for this episode. For a topic for future episodes, perhaps, is to discuss the depreciation or perhaps appreciation of social capital over time. But we can talk about that another time. So thanks again, Lyndon, for this episode. Look forward to the next one.
My pleasure. Thanks for joining us, to you folks out there.